Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to the Near and Queer to My Heart podcast. I'm your host, Amanda G. We are back. I know we took a few months off to live a little life, get some new recordings for y'all, meet some new folks, bring something back to share with our podcast community, and we are so excited for this next episode. This is a local musician, local New Orleans native, Eva Lovullo. Eva has a band of the same name, Eva Lovullo. Right before we recorded this, the band was about to embark on their first tour. Now that this is released, they are back from tour. So if you're in New Orleans, they're performing all over. Check them out. They're probably about to do another tour. So if you're not in New Orleans, also check them out. They're on Spotify, everywhere you listen to music. They're there. I was really excited. Eva and I didn't know each other before this, but like we immediately just got right into it. Of course, talking about my red and green mic covers, very important topic for two Jews who notice those colors in combination all the time. But yeah, it was such an easy conversation. Eva was so lovely. Let's not wait any further. Let's get to it. Let's get to Eva Lovullo.
Someone gave me these mic covers that are supposed to help with the background noise, but I don't know how true
Christmas
that is.
Vibes.
Yeah. I was like, really? These are the colors, bud?
You're like, to a Jew, you would give me these colors?
Where's my Where's my
blue and white covers?
And on Yom Kippur of all days.
Yeah, truly.
But, you know, it's like you can't look a gift horse in the mouth.
Yeah.
I always feel like I mess up sayings, but that's the one, right? You can't look a gift horse in the mouth where I'm like, thank you for like thinking of me and my podcast and bringing me these mic covers. And then it's like, oh, the color. I don't like those colors.
Yeah. I've never heard that saying, first of all. But second of all, you can't, you know, you can't request the different colors for the the mic covers.
Yeah, for sure. Great. Mic covered.
Covered.
Thanks for doing the podcast. I guess to start, I know you're a musician, and I don't know if you want to just talk a little bit about, because I listened to your albums on Spotify.
That's what I was doing
the last couple days. Yeah. Yeah. Get that 2 cents.
It's like 0.001 cents per stream. I've seen no money from Spotify.
I was always wondering that, because if my friends put out like stand-up albums or like local artists that like I go see, and then I'm like, oh, this is awesome, I'm gonna listen on Spotify on repeat and hopefully they're getting some money. And you're like, well, just listen 10,000 times, right? And I'll get a dollar,
maybe 5 million, and I might get $5.
Yeah.
But no, the thing is like, unfortunately, it's Spotify won the clout game, and therefore it's like the easiest user experience. So I constantly default to like sending people to Spotify, because if you get enough streams, then you'll get on playlists, which then means you'll potentially make one like drop in the bucket of the music industry.
Yeah. But you also have to have it out there for when people see you live. And then if they go on Spotify and they don't see you on there, you're right, they won the clout game.
Yeah.
Where they're like, you're not even on Spotify.
Yeah. The funny thing too is that whenever I tell people I'm on Spotify, especially when I was like first starting out, they'd be like, oh, you're on Spotify, you're official. And I'm like, I don't know if I should tell you that you can just pay $10 to this distribution website to get on Spotify. You don't need to like go through any.
Don't tell them. I swear.
Cut that part out.
Yeah.
So people think I'm legit.
Yeah, I know. Like in 2019, I put out like a stand-up thing on YouTube, and the older people in my family are like, you're on YouTube? Yeah. I'm like, it's called YouTube.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, what do people think you have to do to get onto these platforms?
I don't know, but they're impressed, and I don't take it away from them.
It's true. I should just be like, thank you.
Yeah.
I am on Spotify.
Like, it was really hard to click those buttons and give them my credit card. Like,
and they gave me the verified check mark when they realized that I'm a real person, which I just validated.
Yeah.
Yes, I am on Spotify and Apple Music and Tidal and Deezer and all of the platforms.
Yeah, I never know all the things, because that's why I like with the podcast. I'm like, you could just find us on everywhere you get podcasts, because I'm on them, but I don't no, like Deezer and iHeartRadio. I'm like, I don't know how all these things work.
I don't either. But usually, yeah, when I first I see and hear podcasts, they're always like, wherever you can find podcasts. And I'm like, great. So Spotify.
Yeah. So you sing.
Mm-hmm.
You play guitar.
Mm-hmm.
What else? So, what other instruments? When did you start? Were you like one of those kids that like you were just born and you were singing? And your parents were like, look what our kid can do.
Came out of the womb screeching about sad breakup songs. No, my dad's a musician. So I started playing actually Cajun music in his band. He's a Cajun musician here. And we had a family band growing up, which at the time I thought was really lame. And every time I'd have to like not go to a high school party to go play at Mulot's Cajun restaurant and dance hall, I was like, man, this is fucking lame. And then...
What were they called?
Bayou DeVille.
Okay.
Was the band. We played at Jazz Fest and French Quarter Fest and played around a little bit. And I started playing bass in that band, but I've always also been into classical music. So I started playing violin when I was really young and then played classical cello for decades. So I went to New Orleans Center for Creative Arts for cello, classical cello. And that was my main instrument for a long time. But actually around Katrina, I started playing guitar and got really into like sad boy music, like Elliott Smith, Jeffrey Lewis, just like Nick Cave. Like
the Smiths.
Yeah, like. Just getting into it and started writing my own songs, mostly as like a cathartic outlet for how like, yeah, alienated and weird it was to be in a different place. And now I'm in a band called Eva Lovullo, which is my name. My mom's last name, Lovullo. My science name is Eva Frischberg.
Oh, okay.
Because that's actually my
I see why you chose one over the other.
Yeah, I get a lot of shit from it, from my Jewish community. But most of my sad girl parts are from my mom. And I feel like my ability to support myself and organize Excel spreadsheets is from my dad's side of the family. So, yeah. So that's Eva Lovullo. I play guitar in that band. I sing. I write. We just released an EP. We had the EP released last night at Saturn Bar, actually, which was really fun. And we're about to go on tour tomorrow.
Yeah, yeah. I'm glad we caught you before then. So how old were you in 2005 when Katrina happened?
Yeah, so I was about... I was about 11. I just started sixth grade.
Okay, so you were already playing live shows. How old were you when you started that?
I started playing with my dad's band when I was like 6 years old on the Little Triangle and like singing traditional Cajun songs. And without my parents are both artists, so without adequate childcare, I ended up just like living on Bourbon Street with my dad playing music and basically started playing bass in that band because my brother went to college and so he needed a bass player.
Like, he's like, you're up.
Yeah, he's like, you can do these two things, right? Just two fingers moving back and forth. And I was like, I got you. So yeah, I started performing really young and started performing my own music basically as soon as people would let me.
What was that like being 6 years old and being I'm assuming bars, like, yeah, in a different environment than most, the average 6 year old. I won't say most, but I could say the average 6 year old was probably doing. And also like being in front of people and performing, like that was something like that was in your blood, or was that something that like you're like, this is what our family does, or was it, you know, like you just didn't know, you're like, this is what everybody does?
Yeah, I think at the time it felt, you know, because we were like kind of in like a pretty hippie commune of artist musicians growing up in Mid-City. Everybody's parents were artist musicians, and so I was like, this is how everybody is, like we all share childcare and like responsibilities, and also all of us are constantly being like carted around to music festivals or this and that. And so it was kind of the norm, but it was weird to like kind of hold that space and always be like perceived and on stage and have to just kind of like also watch my dad perform constantly and be gone a lot. But it made me really comfortable with being on stage musically, but not in any other capacity. Like I definitely don't like public speaking, but it definitely like kind of made me addicted to also just like the magic that comes with like being able to move people, you know, like with Cajun music, it's like impossible not to have people like dance to it.
Yeah.
And so seeing just like even little kids or like families that come into a restaurant or like a bar in like a bad mood and then shift that, it's just like, I think actually performers get to view more than the person looking at the performer. It's just so cool to watch people's like moods change. And I feel like that kind of magic I became really like addicted to and never wanted to like give up. And then being able to do that in different contexts, like playing in orchestras growing up and like the, you know, power of just being like immersed in like music is just, yeah, it's been a part of my life that I like could not give up.
So you always knew music was your path, or were there other paths? You were like, were you an avid soccer player as well, or was it just music, music, music?
No, my curse is that I like to be mediocre at many things, and so
are you
always...
a Gemini?
I love Geminis, but I'm a Taurus.
Okay.
So I also love my rest, which is why I don't, you know, don't love to like practice 12 hours a day. But this was the issue is that I, you know,
played... I'm a Gemini, by the way. That's why I said that, because we like to know a little bit about a lot of things.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that we're Geminis are mediocre. I'm just like, we just can't sit still, basically.
So real.
Yeah. You learn something and then you're like, I'm going to learn this other thing before I finish learning this other thing.
Yeah, totally. I love Geminis. I constantly am in close friendships, bands, or relationships with Geminis.
Well, that's part of our charm.
Yeah. You really do. You know how to do it all.
We will lure you in.
Yeah, truly. And then keep you.
Yeah.
Forever.
Make you scared to leave.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. No, I had a lot of different interests. It was really hard, actually. When I went to NOCA, I started as a visual artist, and I switched to media arts because I really liked the whole recording process. Then I switched to cello, and then I'd be like hanging out with all the jazz kids doing like jazz cello, and then I'd be doing classical stuff and bailing on my like, you know, quartet rehearsals. But then I was also really obsessed with like academia, specifically psychology, and got really into that. And so it's been really hard to figure out like the right balance. And when I went to college, I decided actually, like, because I was so burnt out on classical music and so burnt out on gigging all the weekends, playing all week and doing soccer, caught me as a soccer player. I was like, I need to take a little break. And I like took a break from music for a little bit and just focused on like the liberal arts agenda and became a really annoying existential philosophy 18-year-old. And then ended up going into a career in science. So the way I pay the bills is like behavioral science or human-centered design and data science and stuff like that. And so I did that for a lot of years, kind of keeping up with the music, still playing for myself and playing out, but just decided like I couldn't take the plunge post-grad to, you know, be a broke musician sleeping on my friends' couches. And I really liked that 401k salary that I was getting. And then, yeah, and now I'm finally actually like quit my big girl job and I'm like kind of full force jumping into the music thing again.
Oh, so you did take the plunge.
Yeah, I moved back to New Orleans from Brooklyn, where I was living for like 4 or 5 years. And yeah, I had this like job that I was working remotely over COVID, and kind of the combination of a lot of different things. I was like, I met this band that I'm in now, and it just like was really working out really beautifully. And one of the musicians that I play with sometimes, who co-produced my album, Katie Martucci, she's like probably my favorite musician ever. And she was like, I want to make an album with you. And she came down, and I was like, if Katie Martucci thinks that I can do music, I can do music.
Yeah.
So I decided to quit my job, and now I just do some part-time consulting with science stuff, but I'm trying to really just like make the music thing happen.
I like science stuff.
Yeah. Hashtag science stuff.
Yeah. That's always been, so I'm 39 right now. And, you know, we were talking before the show, I've been at my job. I graduated school at 25, and then I've been at the literally started that job, have been there all the way through. And as, you know, with my stand-up comedy, like, the longer I do it, the more I'm like, should I take this plunge? But yeah. I'm always too scared to do it because I like health insurance.
Yeah.
And I don't know what I'm scared. You know, I'm obviously a lesbian who's 39, so I'm definitely in therapy. And I've been talking about it with my therapist. She's like, what are you scared of? And I'm like, I don't know. I just can't do it. So whenever someone actually does it, and it sounds like it took some years for you to like really decide to do it. But I mean, I'm assuming it was a little scary, but it sounds like you're in a good place.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we're about to embark on our first tour. So check in after and see if we lost money or made money. But no, it is definitely scary. And honestly, like, you know, I don't think we are necessarily in a society or an economy that supports full-time art. And that really sucks for a lot of people. And who knows if I can ever do it where I'm like not working any hours at a, you know, science job. And I also love it. It's hard to give it up, but definitely is like scary to take that plunge. And I think I'm really lucky to have like a community here, especially like my partner and my family, that are like really like, if you fail at this, you can move in with us. And, you know, like being willing to not have health insurance for a little while and not have savings and just kind of like take the plunge. But in some ways, I actually think the last few years of just like, you know, what's happening in the world and realizing just like how short and scary it is to like live in this world, I was like, well, I might as well not be, you know, letting fuel motivate my actions. Like, I might as well. And I'm lucky that I don't have like kids to support right now, and I don't have elderly sick parents or anything.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I have two cats, which.
Yeah. That's a full time job.
It is, you know, it makes it a little harder to travel.
But, yeah.
There's only so many friends that are like, I will clean your cat's litter for a week while you're gone.
Yeah.
But have you felt like creatively, like something clicked differently, like once you made that decision? Like, was there some sort of freeing? That's what I always imagined in my head. I'd like quit my job and I'd go to comedy full time and I would feel like this freedom, you know, and this creativity that I'd never felt before. Is that true, or am I like romanticizing that in my brain?
I'm sure that has actually come recently, but I quit my job quite a while ago now. And I feel like it was nothing but like regret and existential fear and like, what am I doing? Am I good enough to do this? And also from not focusing on music full time after being like a very competent, like trained musician for a long time, then taking a break, I was like, shit, I'm not that good anymore. So I really have to like work at this again. And I don't have the dedication that a teenager did. And so I think there was like a moment of like not having fun doing it for a while. But all of those like gigs that I was playing and like feeling like, I don't know, stressed to have people come out and support me and wondering if this was the right thing, but keep like putting one foot in front of the other and like pushing it and like reaching out to people and sending my music out and emailing a million labels and practicing with different people and trying to see if I could get the right thing together. I feel like after a year of sort of like that experimentation, I'm now, and like last night's show was the first time that I got to play with like the full band of people that, you know, live in different places but happen to come down for the EP release, and I was like, this is what I've been waiting for. Like, yeah, this is the bliss.
Yeah, I saw the Insta stories and it looked like a lot of fun.
Yeah.
For those who haven't been to Saturn Bar, I took my mom to Saturn Bar once. Nice. And she's like, what is this place?
That's a great question.
I love it. Like, it might collapse at any point in time, but
when people go up on the balcony, yeah, I'm like, please get down. Please.
But it's a small space, and like I feel like the space kind of hugs you in a way. Mm-hmm. And it just feels like, it just feels so, like, I love dive bar feels.
Yeah.
And it just feels like so, you know, warm, and there's like a certain energy in that space. So yeah, like that was probably the right space to choose for your release.
Yeah, I've seen so many good shows there, but like every time I see a good show at Saturn Bar, you can tell that it's like a room full of close friends of the person playing and whoever happens to be getting drunk on like a Tuesday night. And somehow that intimacy and the closeness and the lighting and the dark dunginess of it, it's just like it's so perfect. And I think for our particular sound, which is like guttingly like delicate, like breakup or grief or trauma dumping, basically mixed with like some rocking out catharsis, it's kind of like the perfect space for that.
Yeah. I guess you kind of described your music a little bit, but if you had like two or three words to like, not to put you in a category or a box, but you know, for those who haven't heard you yet, would it just be like sad girl, sad world?
Yeah.
That's not my phrase. That is.
Yeah. The t-shirt, sad girl, sad world brand. I think it's like the words that I've heard recently that I've liked are like breakup bops and kind of like heartbreak anthems. I think our music really just kind of like, I know you're only asked for a couple words.
Yeah.
Describes just like, yeah, the pain of like growing up and being authentic and like fighting imposter syndrome and fighting this like insecurity. And I feel like it's really like my songwriting is cathartic for me to just like spew out all the toxic shit that our brains are constantly telling us about, like our bodies not fitting the right like aesthetic and our like jokes being dumb and falling flat and like never being loved enough and all this stuff. And it's just like somehow that stuff that feels so toxic for me, and I need to get out or else I would go crazy, in addition to having therapists. Shout out to Anna. I think that is like really resonates with a lot of people. And that's why I think, you know, it's like people are, you know, connecting with it, because it's just all of us feel that way.
Yeah, I related a lot to a lot of the songs, like Mom's House. Mm-hmm. Like that definitely like struck a chord with me. But yeah, I relate to all that stuff because for me personally, like I feel all those things, but I don't always know how to express them. And sometimes, you know, in stand up, I'll tell a quick joke, like I'll tell a 20-second joke about a 5-year relationship, you know.
Yeah.
But it's like I didn't delve into that, and I'm making a joke to kind of like find something positive. That's why I like Break Up Bops, because Bops is like a, you know, a positive or anthem. Like those are, you know, what I would consider more positive, you know, words and spins on things. And that's what it is. Like, yeah, some sad shit happens in life. I was actually just talking with someone about this on text last night, and I was like, I tell jokes at the most inappropriate times to other people, but to me they're the most appropriate times, because this is the moment where something, yes, something terrible has happened. Mm-hmm. We can't change that happened. Mm-hmm. We can choose how we deal with it now, and we can choose to acknowledge it. And you know, I don't make jokes like to like someone died and I'm like, oh, that stupid bitch. Like, I'm not like that, but it's like just to relieve the tension or provide in my way. That's how I provide comfort,
right?
Or try to provide comfort. It doesn't always, it doesn't always work. And I feel like, you know, a lot of your songs, you're kind of doing that in a way for yourself, but also hopefully for the audience.
I mean, I think you totally have it spot on. Like, if you're, you can basically, it's like a processing tool, you know? And if you're funny enough, you can say some petty shit. And if you're good enough at music, you can say some really fucked up, mean stuff too. And I feel like that I get surprised too. And like, that's been the most shocking thing to me, is like, my songs are deeply personal and deeply just processing tools for me. But when people in my band kind of like create these melodic lines around them and really connect with them and sort of make them versions of them, that I'm like, oh my God, this is exactly what this song should be. And then people in the audience will tell me like, that just like brought up so much stuff and like helped me. Like, the number one feedback I get when I play shows is people will be like, I'm so sad, thank you. And I'm like, I'm sorry that I brought that up for you, but I also, you're welcome. I guess.
You're like, I guess you're welcome.
So yeah, it's definitely like, I warn people before the show, is like, this is some sad stuff if you're not in the mood to really get down.
Yeah, like if you just took a bunch of acid.
Yeah, maybe not the show for you.
You thought you were going to be rocking out. Yeah.
But the thing is, when you have like, you know, women singing harmony and some like tasty guitar licks, I feel like you can also make it whatever you want it to be, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. So I want to go back. So you said you were 11 when Katrina happened.
Yeah.
What was that? And not to bring up trauma.
I love bringing
at
trauma.
All, but I think, you know, for a lot of, at least the folks I've talked to on the podcast and also in real life that just went through that, it was such like a pivotal moment for a lot of people. It was the first time they ever left New Orleans, period. It was the first time they ever lived somewhere else. And I think you might have been younger, but I know a lot of folks that were in high school left their, like, went somewhere else to go to school, college, went somewhere else, weren't with their families, weren't you know, didn't know if their house was, like, there was all these, all this stuff going on. So I do think it's like a pivotal moment in like the timeline of you and how you got to where you are. But if it's something that you're like, I don't want to relive this shit, I completely understand.
No, I mean, I think it's so true. And like, actually, as I'm thinking about it, when you're just describing it, I think I went from being like happy girl, happy world to sad girl, sad world because of Katrina in a lot of ways. But it was a really, like pivotal moment just in terms of like, I think really the reality is like nothing is guaranteed. People are fallible and everything is unpredictable. That is just like the reality. Mm-hmm. But I think when you have to be introduced to that fact really young, it causes just like a lot of turmoil and a lot of like anxiety about, you know, trusting anything. And Katrina sort of like actually started just like a series of like wild things in my life. Like, we evacuated, we lived in Lafayette for a few years and outside of Lafayette in the country. And it was both like really hard to be, just like constantly in the unknown and having like two parents as musicians, like, I mean, one musician, one artist, there wasn't a lot of like, you know, backup plans, you know, we were kind of just like flying by the seat of our pants. And in some ways, like, it made me really love Lafayette, but I also just like felt so alienated and so different and so like confused and uncomfortable about what was going on. I also was like a pretty weird kid, you know, and was really going through like the worst phase when Katrina hit. I was like, I had just kind of like started to feel more comfortable starting sixth grade, and then we had to evacuate. Like, I was just starting to get friends and had switched schools a lot, and having to leave after starting to feel established and comfortable and start all over again at a different school where everyone was like Christian and had like straight hair. It was just like a very different experience. And then, you know, my family had to like separate because my dad had to come gig in New Orleans as soon as it opened because of like money. And my brother and my dad came back, and we were living in Lafayette. And, you know, music was really like a necessary outlet for me at that time. But it really like prompted just like a decade of sort of like chaos. You know, my mom got sick, also like got cancer through like Katrina, basically.
Oh, wow.
Passed away when I was in high school. And then there was just like, you know, it was a wild time where I feel like I didn't really get my footing until probably like 20 years old, from 11 to 20.
Yeah, because that's interesting. Like, as soon as New Orleans opened up, like, I know a lot of musicians, artists came right back to the city. And that was like a better option for them to, even post Katrina, New Orleans was like a better option for them to make money and do their art.
Yeah, I think artists really, you know, it's hard, right? Because it wasn't a very livable city for a long time, but musicians and artists had to come back. But I think in some ways also, that's what brought New Orleans back, is like the fact that art was still here. People came back and rebuilt because they had to.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing. Like I said, I know that sometimes it's like these are difficult periods, but I think that they're important. How long before you came back?
I came back like a couple years after. I guess I like left right before sixth grade and came back for eighth grade. And so, yeah, it was a very, it was still pretty, like, we lived in Gentilly at the time, and it was pretty empty as a neighborhood. We like were one of the few houses that didn't completely flood. And so it was really weird to like go on like runs in high school and just be like surrounded by houses that hadn't been gutted for years and years. But I remember just feeling like the whole time I was in Lafayette, I was begging my parents to bring me back to New Orleans. And the minute I got back, I was like, this is where my home is. This is where I belong. This is where my people are. And yeah. And then I also just like got super into like making a band and like playing music all the time too, because I was like, felt finally like comfortable again in that space. But it was cool too, because the time that I was away, I was like really working on learning guitar and learning how to like support my voice and songwriting and stuff. And so it was cool to have a place to practice all of those skills when I got back.
Yeah, absolutely. I was just thinking, so my brother's a musician in Los Angeles, and I was just thinking like his band started when maybe junior high, I don't remember. Definitely in high school he had a band, and they didn't really have the options to like play places, you know, like, number one, LA gives a shit if you're underage.
Yeah.
In a way that I don't know if
it's not,
like, especially from what you've told me.
Yeah.
New Orleans doesn't. And number two, any gigs they played, like they had to basically sell like it was a bringer show.
Yeah.
Essentially, where like they could go if they sold 20 tickets or if one of their parents paid $200 or whatever. So like for you being in New Orleans, like you had these options that like weren't always available everywhere else. And that's really cool, like for you to, you know, be able to grow that part of you.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember having like my first like big Christmas present or Hanukkah present. we're Jewish Catholics kind of, was
put a pin in that.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's not revisit that one. The family will listen and be like, which one do you want?
Pick one now.
Yeah. Loyalties, you know, they both care a lot about loyalties in those groups. Yeah. It was like a recording session at Piety Studios, which is no longer around, but it's really sick recording studio in the Marigny. And I remember I made the CD and I was like just trying to sell it to kids at the carpool line at Noka out of my backpack. I was just like, yo, you want some of this good shit? Like, listen to this stuff. But it was so cool because, you know, there was like the Neutral Ground, there was the Big Top, there was all of these places that were like all ages and anyone could play at. And then also just like over Jazz Fest, I would just play on the Blue Bridge for tips all the time. Like, I was just constantly this, like, you know, kid with bangs in my face when Ramones t-shirts trying to like get people to pay attention to me. But there is such a environment of like young artists can run this city, and they do. Like, kids I went to high school with at Noka, especially jazz musicians, were like cleaning up at an early age because the brass bands, you know. And I played like a bunch of weddings and string quartets, and it's just like, it's such a nurturing place. Till it isn't for some people, to be a practicing musician at any age.
But it is a place where you can actually make a living as a musician.
Yeah.
In a way that I don't, I think it might be harder in other cities because they're not as supportive.
There's definitely certain genres too, like as a jazz or a Cajun or a swing musician, like. And when I quit my job, I started actually playing in a Cajun band because that's how I know how to make money.
Roots.
Yeah. And I was like, I could do this anytime, any day, same three chords and different organization. But it is really hard, I think, to be a songwriter and make money anywhere, but especially in New Orleans, because we just don't have the tourist economy for it. And so like figuring out how to have the right balance of like bluesy, jazzy covers and like playing enough Cajun gigs to pay the bills while also, you know, making people bear witness to my sad girl world is like something I'm still figuring out. And there's some really good artists here that, you know, have figured out. Julie Odell, she just moved, Micah McKee, Sarah Burke. They're just like really great songwriters who figured it out, but I'm still learning.
What was the, do you remember the first song you ever wrote?
I remember the first song I ever wrote. I also remember the first rap I ever wrote, which is really embarrassing, but it's always in my head. And it's basically about like society being corrupt. I was like 10 years old. I really had a pulse.
Yeah.
Had a finger on the pulse. But I think I wrote this song actually when I was like 6 years. Yeah, I was probably 5 or 6 about home. And I only remember it because it was like I was typing it out on like the earliest version of Word on my dad's computer with him. And I don't remember how it goes, but it was just basically about how much I loved home in New Orleans and specifically my street in Mid-City, which was Pitchaloop Place, which is close to Blue Oak now. But it was like, yeah, it was probably not a banger, but you know, I remember it fondly.
Like, you never know.
True. I'll have to find it on the hard drive.
Out. We could do a remix.
Oh my God.
You can always mix it into something else.
Oh yeah. A little pop version.
Yeah. So you graduated NOCA when then you went to college somewhere else, or did you stay here for college?
It was a whirlwind. There was this scholarship foundation called Posse, which like sends a group of like 10 kids from public schools.
It doesn't sound real.
Yeah, I know. It doesn't, right? You can look it up after the show. But it basically had its like first year in New Orleans, and my cousin's friend told me about it. And I was like a little bit of a problem child in high school. I made good grades, but I
didn't like you selling your CDs during tests. Yeah, yeah. Like,
I was reckless. We start young in New Orleans, you know? I was like a party child. I started partying very early, and I tried to really make everybody at high school think that I was very cool, and the guidance counselor was not a huge fan. So basically the scholarship foundation required that you nominate you get nominated for it, like by someone who works in the community or your guidance counselor. And I requested to be nominated, but nobody would nominate me. So I called the scholarship fund and nominated myself several times. And I was like, I really highly believe in Eva Frischberg as a candidate. And they were like, just show up to the fucking interview, like stop calling us. And so I did, like, drove myself to this interview, and it was like a 5-month process. It started out with like hundreds of kids, but I ended up getting it. And it was the only way I was going to go to college because I had, you know, no money. But basically, they had two partner schools, Tulane or Bard in upstate New York. And I ended up choosing Bard because I was like, New Orleans is too much right now. I got to go live in the woods in the snow. And so I ended up going to college out there, which was such a culture shock.
Where is it near? Like, what city?
It's like near Poughkeepsie, but 2 hours north of New York City.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was like, just for context.
Yeah. It's a tiny...
Because you could say upstate New York. It could be like...
Anything. It could be Buffalo. It could be Niagara Falls. Yeah. It's like in the Hudson Valley, technically, but that's just like a real estate agent's buzzword for...
Yeah. My mom's from Sullivan County. I don't know if that's near there or not. It's like an hour and ish outside of the city.
Yeah.
2 hours, but I don't know. I don't remember.
That sounds near.
I just know they're... it's near the Catskills. So I don't know.
It was near the Catskills.
Okay. I was like, I feel like that's the same area. But when I visited there as a kid, I had no idea where they were taking me.
Just, it all looks the same. There's some mountains in the back.
Yeah.
Beautiful farms.
So Bard's like a small school.
Yeah. It was like a very small school, like 1900. Extremely sad, poetic philosophy types.
Perfect.
It was perfect for me. And also a bunch of rich kids who pretended not to be rich. And I did not know what I was getting myself into.
Like, they paid someone to rip their jeans.
Yeah, that is exactly the type. It's like the richer they were, the more they looked like they'd been sleeping, you know, in the hallway for the last week. But it was a really cool experience because I got to meet a lot of other like amazing artists and got into some weird music I don't think I would normally. Like, I got super into like electronic music and was in these like synthy looping cello pedal groups and started my first like indie band there, because my band in New Orleans when I was in high school was kind of like a folk pop Cajun influence thing. And this was kind of a sad girl trio where we had like cello, guitar, percussion, and we'd like drive around to different colleges and play in New York City and stuff. And that's really when I was like, oh yeah, this is what I want to be doing.
And what were all your high school band? What was the name? I love band names.
It's always been my name, which is okay. Narcissistic. Eva Lavulo, I think it was. At the time. Yeah, it's always been Lavulo, which is interesting. I was in some ska bands, too, that were like Angry Banana, like just embarrassing stuff. And then in college, it was Bellwether, which was unfortunate because apparently there was another band in like New Haven that was called Bellwether that had like a terrible scandal with the main singer. And so people kept thinking we were that band.
Oh, and you're like, not us.
And so we were like rejected from all kinds of circuits because they just like were like Bellwether. But yeah, it was not
us. We heard about you.
Yeah.
And it wasn't good.
Not great. You know, you can't have men run bands. It's the problem. Like, it's really not.
I think they shouldn't run anything.
Yeah, like, it doesn't work.
Yeah, I'm like, just cancel them all.
The music industry would work if it was run by exclusively non-men.
Yeah, I agree with that. That's our new platform for this whole podcast.
This is the podcast.
I'm shifting the whole gear. So after college, did you go? I know you said you lived in Brooklyn for a minute. Like, yeah. Did you go right to Brooklyn? Did you try to come back here? Did you go to California?
Yeah, I wish I'd gone to California. No,
you were like, I love winter. Where can I get more winter?
Yeah, where can I just be sad and cold and lonely all the time
and have the weather match?
Yeah, exactly. See, this is actually my issue with California. No hate on California. My partner's from Los Angeles. I love visiting, but I feel so not sad girl, sad world enough in like LA and San Francisco. I'm just like, what do I write about? I'm like getting enough vitamin D. I'm going on hikes. I'm eating avocados. I feel fine. I could just, you know, live like this.
Yeah.
Like, I need some suffering.
Yeah. You're like, I feel too healthy.
Yeah, exactly. I can't write.
You can't write about that.
I don't know how people make art.
I want a song
there
about you being too healthy.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I could do it, but I mean, I'd make a joke now that I'm in like a securely attached relationship because of therapy that the only thing I can write about now is like the possibility of losing it because I just have no more sad girl heartbreak bops in me. But yeah, I actually decided when I was like upstate that I wasn't going to come back to New Orleans for a long time. I thought I was going to either move to California or, you know, stay in upstate New York for a while. And I got this job in New York that was like really incredible, doing social impact work through the lens of like human decision making science. And it was like everything I loved from college, like social psych, but applied. So it wasn't just studying like rich white kids in college settings. Yeah. It was actually like doing community involved work. And I worked really closely with the mayor's office and their different initiatives that they were running. And it was great. I lived there and worked in that world for like 4 years and also played music and like got to collaborate with all of these people. My approach to music making at that time was like going on dates with people, starting to create albums with them, and then breaking up and never getting those albums back.
Yeah, and so, then you could write about not getting those albums back.
Exactly. I still want those albums back. So if you hear this,
send them back.
Know that my drive is open. Yeah, for those files.
You haven't forgotten.
I have not forgotten about those songs. But yeah, most of my music making was just like friends and collaborators that I would end up having weird flings with and never being able to perform.
Yeah. So what made you decide to leave Brooklyn? Like, what was that journey?
Yeah, I started to like feel kind of the pressure. Like, New York is just a hard place to live, and I think there are pockets of sort of the community and the warmth and the humanity that New Orleans has in spades there if you are generationally wealthy or have the time and energy to like manifest it. But I just couldn't, like, I just saw myself being more and more like kind of immersed in sort of like the obsession, like the workaholism and the like productivity culture and the busyness and like constantly trying to like get ahead at my job and like apply to other jobs. And I was just like, I had no time for anything. And it was really just like wearing on me that I was also becoming kind of this like more vapid, Instagram obsessed, like cared about streetwear culture and all this weird shit that I just never cared about. And I was like, I think every time I would come home to New Orleans, my best friend Grace had moved down here and she was working in climate justice and, you know, started this like food mutual aid food group. And it was just like seeing her kind of like dig back into the place that raised us and like made us the people that we were and give back to this like city And then also like living in this communal house, sharing meals every day. Like I ate every meal on the subway, like on my way home from work. Yeah. And I was like dying because of it.
Wherever you got it, probably never made it fast enough.
No, never.
I feel like they'll give it to you in 10 seconds and you're like, this could have been 9 seconds.
Yeah, exactly. Like disgusting.
You get very I lived in New York for a few years and mm-hmm. I got very aggressive.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, this isn't me, but it is me.
Yeah.
But it's not the me. It's not the me I want to be.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, part of my impetus for like moving to New Orleans, but then staying here.
Yeah. You know, it makes you a version of yourself that's like, I know that I have to be this because I have to match everyone else's energy, but I don't want to be averting my eyes to everybody on the sidewalk.
Yeah.
Like when I moved back, Grace was like, you didn't say hi to anybody we just passed. And I was like, why would I?
Yeah, you're like, they're just going to rob me or harass me. Or
like spit on me.
Yeah, I'm like, one too many things. That's what it is. It's like one too many things happens in New York. Like I always tell people this story. One time on the subway, like a homeless guy clotheslined me.
Oh my God.
He just walked by me, put his arm out, like, and I'm 5'2". This guy was like probably 6 foot.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, what the fuck just happened?
For no reason.
Yeah, and so after that, it's like, yeah, I got a little mean.
Yeah.
And yeah, I avoided, you know, men mostly.
Yeah.
Or any situation where that could happen again, because it happened. And then, yeah, when you get here, you're just like, oh, people just want to say hi.
Yeah.
But you're on high alert because of experiences.
Yeah. It takes like 6 months to a year, I feel like, to soften the icy exterior.
Yeah. Let the shoulders kind of relax a little bit.
It's so real. The hypervigilance also. I'm like, this can't be good for my nervous system. I'm going to be like having ulcers by the time I'm like 35. I can't hang. Like, yeah. I remember one time I was on the subway, I was like eating a salad, which never should do on the subway. And I was like, it was open.
That's impressive.
Yeah, it was not the move. It was late, so whatever.
Okay, but I was like, the subway jerks a lot. Like,
I know. It was not working out well. But you know, Sweet Green and their $20 salads has its hold on me as a young person. And this man was like smoking a cigarette on the subway, normal stuff.
Yeah, sure.
Totally. And he was like, fine. Can I have some of your salad? And normally if I wasn't that hungry, I might have given it to him, but I was like, no man, like I need this salad. And he fucking ashed his cigarette in my salad. And
oh my
he was
God.
Like, basically none of us can enjoy it.
Oh fuck.
And at that point I was like, man.
Yeah, because you're like, what do you do? You're
yeah.
just like, okay, I can fight him, I can yell at him.
Yeah.
But
just gave up.
Yeah, it's like, it's not worth it.
Yeah. So the combination of New York wearing me down and then also COVID hit while I was kind of having this like radicalization of like, do I believe in this nonprofit's mission? Do I believe in anything anymore?
Yeah.
Kind of was happening. And I was like, I got to get out of New York for COVID. I don't think I could have handled it in that small of like a, you know, apartment. And so I moved back down to New Orleans or to Lafayette actually to move in with my dad. And I started, you know, just being back in Louisiana, I was like warm. And I always like tell people too that like I feel like the most like authentic and also like interesting, attractive person in like Louisiana, that in New York, I'm just full of, I'm like a walking self-doubt machine, you know? And it's not like I don't have that here, but I just like felt like I belong here. I feel like familiar. And my friend Grace has been like trying to convince me to move back forever. And she won. I was like, yeah, let's move in together. Well, let's do it.
Sounds like she wasn't wrong.
No, I mean, she knows what's best for me.
Yeah. Yeah. So tell us a little bit. I know you're going on, you said this is your first tour.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Tour. Tell us a little bit about that. Yeah. I think you're going east.
Yeah. So we're leaving tomorrow.
I did some light Facebook stalking.
Hell yeah. You only need Instagram a little. I post stalking. A lot.
Yeah. So. No. I mean, you did a good job. Like artists shouldn't make it hard to find mm-hmm. out what they're doing.
Yeah. Yeah.
In a non-creepy way.
No. I mean, yeah, I was thinking actually, because I had this hashtag called Thick Thighs Save Lives on one of my TikToks. And then I got a bunch of followers really quickly. And I was like, I don't know if these are the people that I want knowing exactly what location I'm going to be at all over the country.
But good to know that some hashtags work. Yeah. I feel like I throw in all these hashtags and I never get new followers. And I'm like, how are other people doing it? And it's like,
there's thirsty ones.
Yeah.
It's got to be the thirsty ones.
I guess I need more thirst traps.
Yeah. You got to just like hit them with the thirst traps. The advice that music industry people keep giving me is like, yes to thirst traps, stop with the political stuff, nobody understands your Yom Kippur jokes. And I'm like, okay, but I enjoy them, so yes. I'm not gonna change. But yeah, we're going through Birmingham. We're actually playing, this got confusing because we played at Saturn Bar last night, we're playing at Saturn in Birmingham tomorrow night, so a lot of people thought the show was tomorrow, so if you didn't come last night, I understand. And then we're going through Asheville, Fleetwood's in Asheville. We're going to Baltimore, Philly, and then back to my home in New York, second home in New York, which are the two locations that I used to play a lot, Rockwood and Pete's Candy Store.
Oh, nice.
And I'll get to see a lot of my old music collaborators and friends. And yeah, I have such a rich community there too that I'm really excited to see. But really excited for our first tour. It is a lot of work to plan a tour.
Yes, it is.
But I am, in some ways, I feel like everything happened for a reason, because having worked in human-centered design, right? Like I work with all of these like companies and governments to make things easier, right? To like make it clear what information you need to know to be able to act on a certain thing, and design a lot of websites and apps and products. And so I feel like that ability, not to say I'm a pro at it, because I'm definitely not, has allowed me to like at least know a sense of like what email will be like most attention grabbing at the right time to be able to get people to come to my show. So I'm constantly collecting data also on like what time I tell people to show, which versus when they come. And so like figuring out what time to actually go on to get the most number of people there. So if you come, know that I will be studying you in depth.
I need to do more of that. Like me and another comic are going, we're just going to like Atlanta, South Carolina, Alabama for a couple of days. And I get such anxiety with the booking, because I don't want to reach out to too many people, because I don't want them to get back to me and potentially like be offered two shows at the same date at the same time and have that stress. And I don't want to reach out too soon or too late. Like it just, that whole thing gives me anxiety, but you see it as like you're like, I'm going to study this and I'm going to master it.
Yeah.
Maybe I should look at it that way instead of like, I am so stressed about this. But I also want to travel and do shows. So
yeah, I think a certain degree of like shamelessness, recklessness, and also like, yeah, science mindedness around it is necessary, because whenever I think about the reality of I am asking people to bear my soul on their stage and them to give me money, I am paralyzed to do anything. But when I think of it in terms of like, me and thousands of other people are all trying to like just do our thing, I'm just gonna like relentlessly email people and like be nice about it, but just like see what sticks. And that's how I've like gotten anything done, is just like see what sticks.
Yeah, absolutely. All I will ask you one more question, and it's gonna feel like it comes out of the blue, but I love this. So I'm like, I'm Jewish. Mm-hmm. Like Ancestry DNA says 100%.
Wow,
like,
look at you. You know,
we were an isolated bunch for a very long time. Mm-hmm. But you said that you're like Jewish and Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, which guilt is worse? Because you have the Jewish guilt,
yeah,
you know, and the Catholic guilt, and they're similar but yet different. Mm-hmm. Like I had a girlfriend that was raised very Catholic,
yeah,
and at first I was like, great, we both have these guilt issues, childhood trauma to share. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, oh, yours are different.
Yeah, totally different. I think the Catholic guilt, because it was non-consensual, because I was baptized Catholic without knowing as a baby.
Yeah. You got to protect your soul.
Yeah.
Obviously.
I don't want to take any chances with my soul, considering all of my past demons.
Yeah.
I think the Catholic guilt in some ways is worse, only because Catholics have less fun. And like Jewish guilt is like something that I feel like we all just like can make fun of, and we're always like joking about, and there's a lot of just like camaraderie and yelling, and you know, yeah. I love Jewish holidays 90% because of how much arguing there is.
Yeah.
But the Catholics will just hold a grudge for 5 years and not tell you why.
Oh, that's not fun.
No.
That's part of the shtick.
Yeah.
Like my last girlfriend, when I brought her to like a family thing, she's like, all you do is yell at each other. And I was like, no, we're just talking.
Yeah.
And none of us were loving. Mad. We're just, it's like all everything is a friendly debate.
Yeah. It's like, make fun of me, argue with me, and I know that you love me.
Yeah.
But the Catholics are just like, I know that my grandparents have an opinion about the fact that my partner's name is Elon Glickman, but nobody wants to talk about it.
Yeah.
I'm like, what?
Yeah, it's like, come on, this is, like,
talk about your feelings.
Yeah.
They also, yeah. It's, I think the Catholic guilt is worse, but I try not to participate in it so much anymore.
Yeah, sometimes it's not your choice. It's like, but you know, I'm like, oh, let me call my mom and see how she's doing. And then it's like, oh, I didn't do things I was supposed to do, apparently.
Yeah. And then you really will know about them.
Yeah.
The good thing with the Catholics is that if you decide to opt out of reading between the lines, you can pretend like everything's okay. Like if you decide that text that's like, yeah, I'm happy to help, isn't actually, you should have like called me back 10 months ago when I wished you a happy birthday.
Yeah.
Then, you know, it's fine. The Jews in my family will just be like, why haven't you called me?
Yeah. No, I know. It's like I was waiting by the phone. Wait for me to die before you call me?
Yeah, exactly. Is the next time you visit going to be my funeral? Yeah. I'm like, damn.
Yeah.
Got him.
There's that one. There's this one cartoon or this meme that was going around, and it was like someone, it was like they were in a coffin and their mom walked by and was like, you're wearing that to your funeral.
So real.
It's just, yeah, I was like, that just hit home.
Yeah.
All right, well, let everyone know where they, I know this is going to come out, we're recording before your tour. Mm-hmm. We're going on tour tomorrow.
Yeah.
This is a recording, so I'm not going to have it edited and released before the tour, but by the time this comes out, you might have another tour or gigs, so or true. You know, let people know where to we already made it clear, Spotify, Apple Music, mm-hmm. anywhere you listen to music, they'll find you. But social media tags, you know, where people can find you. Thick thighs save lives hashtag.
Yeah, that will be the number one. Yeah, the easiest way is Evilovullo, which is, some people can't spell it, so EVALOVULLO on Instagram, Facebook, evilovullo.com. we have an email list. I know everybody's Ooh. Trying to quit social media for the new year, so
are they?
I mean, I think they are.
Okay, I'm too old. People's, I don't know what everybody's doing.
Mental health is plummeting. I think they need a break from Instagram.
I get it.
But yeah, a lot of people don't show, or like are like, I didn't even know you were on tour. And I'm like, oh yeah, you deleted Instagram. That's why you've been my most healthy friend for the last 6 months. So if you want to subscribe to the email list, it's there. And yeah, we're on Spotify, Apple Music. We just released new music. We're going to be recording again in January. So check out the music.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for doing the podcast and being part of the Near and Queer to My Heart family.
Yeah.
And when you're back in town, I'm definitely going to check out a gig.
Oh yeah.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to say some quick thank yous, and then at the end of the episode, we will be playing Eva's song, Tried to Be Everything. Big thank you to our guest for sharing her world with you. Special thank you to Ryan Golub for creating our theme song. We'd love to hear from y'all. Social media with us, Twitter at Queer to My Heart, Instagram and Facebook at Near and Queer to My Heart. And the best way, it's free. Show us some love. Apple Podcasts, 5-star rating, please. Thank y'all so much. Here's Eva's song. Take care. Thank you.
Tonight you told me to crack my window so I could remember being cold with you. Nothing but tattered pillows to hold on to you.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.